Right. Oh, it works. Excellent. Well, my starting point is really that if you were well adjusted to the values and attitudes of the status quo that the ruling elite have been offering us for the last 30 years in this society, you would be seriously putting your mental health at risk. It's as serious as that, how badly wrong we've gone. And at the most simple level, I can explain that by saying, well, it is the case that we're about, and this is based on very good evidence, about 5 times more likely to be mentally ill, particularly a young person, today, compared with a young person in the 1950s. So there are problems that have started in the 1950s, accelerated in the 60s and 70s, things like the rising divorce rate, but fundamentally the shift from collectivism, in which your identity is conferred upon you by your family and by your social class and your gender and your social position, a collectivist society, which was rejected very, very strongly in the 60s and very forcefully replaced by individualism, in which your identity is achieved through education and your career. And certainly the shift from collectivism to individualism, for which, of course, religion is quite a protection against that. If you have a weekly religious observance of some kind or spiritual practice of some kind, you are significantly less likely to be mentally ill than somebody who doesn't. And that a big reason for that is probably because you're more likely to be community-minded and part of a community. But for the great majority of the population who are very secularist, as we all know in this modern age, individualism is king. And that's one reason why we're more mentally ill. But I'm not really going to be concentrating on that this evening. I'm going to be speaking more about another very, to me, startling statistic, which is that if you live in an English-speaking, Anglo-centric nation, whether that be this one or America, but also New Zealand, Australia, or Canada, very good evidence from the World Health Organization, which is not really, it's not a problem, this evidence, it really is solidly based, not like the happiness evidence, which is much more unclear and much less scientific, I think. Proper studies of the populations, nationally representative samples of the populations show that you are twice as likely to be mentally ill if you live in English-speaking society compared with mainland Western Europe. So about 23% of us are mentally ill at any one time in this society, compared with only exactly half that proportion of 11.5% in continental mainland Europe. Now, I think at a very simple level, the implication of that is if we'd, in 1979, if we had simply adopted the Danish approach to social organization, a Danish political economy, we would be half as likely to be mentally ill. It's as simple as that, I believe. But I'll come in more detail to the argument about the role of political economy in mental illness. Before that, I just want to quickly let you know the latest evidence on genes, because that has been a rising tide in the last 20 or 30 years. It's been a tendency to attribute things to genes. At the broadest level, there's been a strong tendency towards what's called social Darwinism, in which it's assumed that the reason the poor are poor, the mad are mad, the bad are bad, is because of their genes. And Darwinism is the reason that there's a selection of the survival of the fittest. Well, that argument has taken a huge hit from, ironically, the very source that the geneticists thought was going to prove that it was that mental illness is caused by genes, namely the Human Genome Project, which immediately when the results were first announced in 2001, there were only 25,000 human genes. And it was immediately pointed out by one of the key researchers that that made it very unlikely that something as specific as a mental illness could be caused by genes. But it's then subsequently been the case that they have not been able to find individual genes for individual mental illnesses like depression, schizophrenia, and so on. And so much so that even the most gung-ho of geneticists have admitted that they never will find a gene for any of the major mental illnesses, which isn't to say that some things aren't genetic, because I do think that, for example, autism, I'm pretty convinced is. They just haven't yet found a gene for it, but I think they will find genes for that. But I think that they will not find, and that they are now admitting that they think it's quite unlikely, that their fallback position is to say it's lots of interacting genes. But actually, even that hasn't been shown at all, and it may well never be shown. The other fallback position is to say it's a case of genes create a potentiality, the environment fulfills it. Well, again, whenever they've tried to establish that, it hasn't worked out. A classic example being the serotonin transporter, where they found a variant of that, and they thought they'd cracked it because it showed that people with this variant who were abused as children subsequently were more likely to become depressed. Unfortunately for them, the study has been repeated many times and absolutely shown that it's not true, that this gene actually does not predispose you to become depressed if you're maltreated as a child. So it's an important proviso, that, because it has become very widely assumed that genes are critical, and I'm telling you that the evidence does not show that. What the evidence does show is that if you place a high value on money, possessions, appearances, and fame, one or all of those, you are statistically significantly more likely to suffer from the commonest problems, from depression, anxiety, personality disorder, substance abuse. Isn't that interesting? An amazing body of evidence, that. It's based on something like 15 studies in different nations, in lots of different age groups, representative samples, etc. It's not just based on studying students. Placing a high value on money, appearances, keeping up with the Joneses, social appearances and physical appearance, and possessions and fame makes you more prone to mental illness. Well, I believe that is the main explanation for why we are so much more mentally ill than people in mainland Europe. Because the thing that causes people to be so materialistic, or what I called it, affluenza, to just draw attention to it, but really the correct term for what I've just said is materialism, placing a high value on money, possessions, appearances, and fame. What causes that, more than anything else, is the kind of political economy we've had for the last 30 years, which you can call Thatcherism, free market economics. I call it selfish capitalism. Selfish capitalism massively increases our tendency to be materialistic. If you follow through the logic, if being more materialistic makes you more mentally ill, and you're in a nation where materialism is systematically increased through the political economy, namely Thatcherism, selfish capitalism, it's not surprising that the countries that are the most selfish capitalist, which are indeed the Anglo countries, America and us being the worst, but Australia actually is terrible as well. New Zealand and Canada less so. But still, they're more materialistic than continental mainland Europe. And that really is, the crucial point that I want to make to you tonight, really, is to say that we've been living in a ridiculously poisonous social environment caused by a certain kind of political economy. What are the mechanisms by which materialism makes you mentally ill? Well, I think many of you will be able to, will have probably got there already. What the answer to that is very simple. It makes you, if you're very materialistic, conflate real needs with confected wants. you think that you need a new kitchen or conservatory or all these obsessions we have with our houses. Actually, you only want it. You don't need it. And it's important to understand the difference between the kind of materialism we have, which is called relative materialism, and survival materialism. Nobody has ever been made mentally ill in a third world developing nation by wanting to get hold of some antibiotics for their child who's otherwise going to die because they've got a bacterial infection. Of course, if you have that kind of survival materialism, doesn't make you mentally ill at all. It's the relative variety that we suffer from, in which we say, I really need a coffee, through to, we really do need to build a new kitchen, as you sit looking at your old kitchen. And of course, we all know that within about 2 months or 3 months of installing the new kitchen, you become completely used to it, and it doesn't make a blind bit of difference to the quality of your life. This kind of materialism puts having before being. That famous book by Eric Fromm called To Have or To Be sets out much of what I'm saying, and set it out over 50 years ago. Crucially, in the selfish capitalist world and in the English-speaking world, in America, they've been subjected to four times more money being spent on advertising and marketing to them as populations compared with mainland Europe since the 60s. And in our country, twice as much. We spend so much more time watching television, which of course has become increasingly mind-rotting, whether it's the stuff between the programs, the advertisements, or unfortunately, it's become very hard to tell, just as in the newspapers, you can't tell the comments separate from the news. The facts, both fact and comment, that distinction has collapsed. It's increasingly the case. You can't, especially with product placement, it's quite a job, especially in American programming, to tell what's an advertisement and what isn't. And most American programming is essentially an advertisement for a certain kind of lifestyle and some very, very cockeyed values. Nowhere, of course, I think, has it been more obvious how mad we've become as a society than the leaders we've had in the last, 30 years. But and I'm not just talking about the publicly known fact that the Alistair Campbells and the David Blunkets have been suffering from depression. I'm saying that the state of, that they really aren't happy bunnies, the people who live in Notting Hill. The ruling elite, if you have the misfortune to come across them socially, they're not happy bunnies. And I've interviewed many high achievers over the years, and I can tell you that there's plenty of evidence for what I'm about to say, scientific, but speaking anecdotally, that these are people, in the vast majority of cases, these are people who are compensating for feelings of worthlessness and powerlessness through their achievement. Of course, it was towards the end of the last government's days, it was deeply depressing seeing the likes of, on that Channel 4 documentary, of Stephen Byers, Jeff Hoon, Patricia Hewitt, caught on a hidden camera saying that they were desperate to try and find work that would bring them lots of money. The greed and obsession with money that dominated New Labour was truly deplorable. So having had 30 years of political economics in which the mantra has been greed is good, backed up by the sort of selfish gene, and that book was published as The Selfish Gene by the dreadful Dawkins, was published in 1976. He doesn't like me saying this, but it didn't actually become a success and a widely sold book until the 80s, when it was adopted by Thatcherites and similar thinking people as a supposedly scientific justification for their political economy. And we've had 30 years of this. It's been very difficult for the ruling elite to think anywhere. There is no plan B for the ruling elite at all. The only way they can conceive of the way out of the present problem with the credit crunch is through more consumption, keep interest rates low, so we still remain addicted to our houses and house prices up by that means, consumption and economic growth are going to be the only way out. They have no plan B. But a huge change is going to have to happen to the values of our leaders and the kind of people who become them. I have a strong view that the best way to decide whether the ultimate test of whether someone should be allowed to be an MP is whether they've had to look after an under 3-year-old for a minimum of 1 year full time without any assistance. That would create a much more interesting, would be very, very interesting if that was the case. But sadly, for the time being, the credit crunch has happened, and we get the sign that nothing, no change has happened. But it does give me enormous pleasure to think that in the near future, our leaders will have no alternative to zero growth as an economic model. And I find it extraordinary that you can say something like that, that you can actually say, with really pretty good likelihood of it being true, that somewhere in anywhere between 5 and 50 years' time, the new orthodoxy will be at the end of the fiscal year. People will say, oh, thank God, we didn't have any economic growth this year. Thank goodness I didn't earn any more last year because I'm not consuming anymore, so the planet might, my grandchildren might still have a chance. That is how we'll be thinking. I'm convinced of it. I'm not an expert on climate change, but I trust people like Jonathan Porritt, for example, who I know a bit, and somebody as intelligent as that, or some lot of scientists. The chief scientist David King is of this opinion. I think it isn't a minority opinion; it's the real tiny minority are the climate skeptics. And I want to use a little bit of time before, because I want to give you the maximum chance to ask questions. To say, first of all, that I think that this change not only will happen, but also that it can happen very suddenly. I'm old enough to remember, Thatcherism in 1979. If you told me what was about to happen, I'd have been laughing in your face. I was a generation of people who, when we left university, the only thing that was prized was to be a social worker or a university lecturer. And Monty Python, by the point when I left university, Monty Python had only just finished completely destroying the reputation of accountants. The idea of becoming an accountant in 1976, people would have just fallen about laughing if he suggested that. Likewise, and also in 1979, if you'd said to me the public schools are still going to be completely robust in 2010, I'd have said, ha, you must be joking. I mean, there didn't seem any chance of that. So incredibly big change occurred. To give Thatcher her due, she was damn good at what she did because it was unbelievable the scale of the change that resulted from her. And likewise, another big change that's happened in my lifetime is the Soviet Union. Who predicted that? I still can't get my head around the fact that the Soviet Union's disappeared. And disappeared really almost without any violence, just a public uprising. So if those things can happen, anything can happen. America is incredibly fragile. I've been saying this for a long time. China, even, is also, it's widely agreed to be a very, very fragile setup. Huge changes, seismic changes can happen in the political sphere. We're going to run out of oil. The peak oil point has not been taken on board by most people in the ruling elite. We're going to run out of oil much quicker than everybody realizes, I believe. And that's before you get to things like East Anglia suddenly disappearing underwater, which I think is the real thing, though, that is going to make the difference. So however much I may argue against consumerism and however much I may argue against affluenza and the harm it does, sadly, I don't think that those arguments in themselves are going to win the day, although I do think people were sick to the back teeth with consumption at the point when the credit crunch came. So there is a kind of general Ah, thank God for that. That's nearly over. We don't have to be so obsessed with our possessions. I think there is a big feeling in the country at large. But obviously, alongside that, there's a lot of people very worried about their jobs and very worried that they're not going to have any money. The interesting thing, though, is the processes that will control whether the change happens and how it changes. I mean, at one level, it just may require revolution. It may require that East Anglia goes underwater and suddenly everyone wakes up and smells the coffee and completely changes their attitude. That may be what happens. But equally, it's possible that the rational case for a change in values could occur. And I think climate change will be the driver of it. But there's a very interesting research done by Tim Kasser and Clive Hamilton on why so many people find it hard to take climate change on board and what the way we defend against it. And they show that there were really three different groups of people. The first are people who just deny climate change as a threat. And they're the minority, but they're the people like the sort of mad dog climate skeptics, the so-called, you know, the sort of the really extreme people who just say it's all, you know, the flat earthers who say this evidence has all been made up and it's just false. That kind of denial. Although there's a lot of other people. I mean, I had a great friend who was quite a senior person in television who did this, who would just simply sort of skip about, disengage from a conversation about it. If you tried to talk to him about it, he just didn't want to talk about it. He just tried to avoid it in the news. And that's what a lot of people, the deniers will do, is just change channel if something scary comes on about climate change. The second group, who are probably the majority of people, are what Kasser and Hamilton called the maladaptive responses. So they accept the facts of climate change up to a point, but the emotional impact is not really felt. So they blunt the facts or find ways to fudge it. So they might reinterpret the threat by saying, oh, well, human beings have dealt with these kinds of problems in the past. We can solve this kind of thing through technology. Or they might say, oh, well, you know, okay, maybe it is going to happen, but it's a long way off. Or they may use diversionary tactics. So they do, as so many of us have probably done, they stop using plastic bags in the supermarket and start bringing bags their own, or maybe do a bit of loft insulation or whatever. But that's unfortunately not going to be enough. Or blame shifting. So they say, well, it's not my fault that this is happening. My footprint is small. And then there's sort of like the Norwegians blaming the Americans, or everybody blames China. You know, it's that kind of shifting of blame. And then the third category, which is also a minority, is the ones who actually have what Kasser and Hamilton would call adaptive coping, which is that they accept both the facts and really feel the emotions that go with the facts, and adjust to the new circumstances and take real appropriate action. And the people who really have done adaptive coping are have to go through a process of mourning and expressing and coping with the emotion that realizing the damage that climate change is bringing and will bring. They have to really take it on board. They then move out of that into a state of problem solving, and then on from there into new values. And the advice for campaigners that Tim Kasser and Clive Hamilton offer is to help people to express the emotions that arise if you really take on board climate change as a problem. Try to gently point out the refusal to face the science, and then offer problem-focused strategies. Now, this is obviously all going to, be much harder to do in a selfish capitalist society where we're all addicted to consumption. But as I say, I think the major catastrophes are actually going to blast through the defences of the deniers and the maladaptives. And so, I suppose my message tonight is a positive one. It's not, I think, Panglossian optimism, but I think based on the idea that the instinct to cooperate is every bit as strong as the instinct to be selfish. And, you know, that as in the Second World War, there are times when everybody pulls together, that collectivism can prevail and often does. Of course, it's possible that horrendous disasters of the future, I mean, if the oil, for example, runs out before climate change hits us, that could, it could, things could turn very nasty, but equally things could go a lot better. If you think back to that brief moment a few years ago when the oil tanker drivers went on strike, and you thought, blimey, I need oil, you know, I depend on oil. You suddenly realized how strongly dependent on oil you are. And I think that people may find if that happens before climate change or whether it's climate change, that people may actually rediscover to quite an extent their cooperative tendency. And I think get back to basics, you know, get back to things like growing our own food and relying more on communities. I think that can, and I do think that that will happen. Thank you. Now, I kept myself on as short a leash as possible because I think that at an event like this, you're probably going to want to have your say. And, you know, you don't feel you just have to ask questions. I mean, please do ask questions if you'd like. But if you want to, if you have an observation to make, perhaps you disagree with me, I'd be very interested to hear it. And the process by which this is going to be done is that this gentleman here is standing here with a microphone. And the people, what you have to do, I believe I'm right in saying, is come, if you could form an orderly queue, at the front here, if you have a question to ask, although some people might be made shy by doing that.
They usually get over it. We found. But if
right, so
they would have the spotlights upon
them. Come down and take your place.
If you do, however, have problems coming forward, please put your hand up and I'll come out to speak to you better.
Well, that's going to make you very, very shy.
Yes.
I'm the one who doesn't want to come up.
That's right. Just before we start taking questions, I've been asked to point out that there will be a book signing in the G Books venue after the talk. So if you just give him enough time to get across there, you can join him there to sign some books. Okay, anyway.
Thank you very much indeed for your very cogent and articulate description of the issue. My question is, in a society where you're describing 23% of people as having a mental illness, what advice do you give to those of us who want to do something reparative in terms of ourselves and our children to actually act and behave in a different way that will try to improve the chances for our grandchildren and the future?
So do you mean, obviously, you don't mean kind of that I suggest you go and see a therapist?
No, I'm not thinking about that. But what I'm thinking is, in a sense that, what I understand you saying is...
What kind of thing have you got in mind here?
Well, I think what you're saying is that we're in a society in which the influence of the media and the culture is such that we look at, I think you said, greed, consumption, the media, an obsession with appearance, and so forth.
That's right. Money, possessions, appearances, and fame. Yeah.
What do we do as individuals to actually try with our children to provide an alternative to that obsession? Because we have children who are growing up in a society that values those particular things. How do we provide an alternative strategy?
Well, probably many of the people in this room already do the sort of things I'm about to say, but for example, try and restrict the amount of time your children spend watching television, which my wife, who's in the audience today, she is extremely good at doing, and I'm less good at doing. Obviously, you know, things like computer games, you know, obviously try and keep that sort of stuff down. I mean, all the obvious, I don't know, but I've got anything very original to add to the obvious points that, say, Sue Palmer in Toxic Childhood is much better than I am at providing a detailed account of all the things you can do. But obviously, I suppose the one area where I probably am a little bit more gung-ho than her would be education, which completely gives me the creeps, as I tried to describe in the relevant chapter in my book, Affluenza. You know, I find the modern education system is an absolute disgrace and has the extraordinary achievement of making most people leave school feeling like failures, however well they've done. You know, the most mentally ill group of people in this society are 15-year-old girls from the top social class who are also, you know, stunningly good at getting A pluses in their GCSEs, and yet they feel like failures more than any other group. So I think with the education, I think definitely protect your children, you know, encourage what's called intrinsic motivation as opposed to extrinsic motivation, which there's a huge literature. Anybody who's interested in the science of it, go to, there's a website called Self-Determination Theory, all one word. Self-Determination Theory. Just put that into Google. You'll find a treasure trove of scientific evidence that intrinsic motivation is better than extrinsic motivation. Extrinsic being reward and praise motivated, as opposed to doing something because it gets you into the zone, because you enjoy it. And obviously, the education system that we have at the moment is a disgrace in that respect, and is essentially an extension of the human resources departments of corporations, really. It's just a way of trying to distinguish which people to employ.
That was great. I would like to ask you more questions about that, but I better stick to my originally planned question. You were quite scathing of our sort of political economic situation in our country and others similar to it, but you mentioned Denmark. Could you just briefly compare us to Denmark and tell us why they're doing it better?
Yes, although the one thing that they're not doing very, the one mistake they have made is that they do have daycare for 3/4 of the population are in daycare nurseries from the age of 18 months, which is controversially, I rather disagree with. But apart from that, pretty much, I can't really find any fault with them at all, in the sense that the foundation of their success, according to the equivalent of the Guardian editor in Copenhagen, is a guy called Toke Seidenfaden, and he told me that the heart of it was the gender roles, the way, and this is the point about the Scandinavian model, is that they anticipated what the consequences of feminism would be, that somebody would be left to have to be left holding the baby, and also that women, you know, the need for women to get out of the home and into the workplace was one thing. But then somebody was, you know, the domestic household economy somehow got to kept going. Well, the way they've done that is the men genuinely, I mean, this guy is the editor of The Guardian in Copenhagen. He stops work at 4:30. He really does work a 35-hour week. You know, Alan Rusbridger, not a chance. You know, and they also, funnily enough, they have a system there which is very democratic. They, of course, they have very low inequality, as Kate Pickett would have been talking about tomorrow, although sadly I believe she can't come. You know her book with Richard Wilkinson, the Spirit Level. Inequality is one of the unavoidable consequences of selfish capitalism. In unselfish capitalist societies, there's much less of a gap between the rich and the poor. So, the taxi driver who took me to visit Toga only earns 6 times less than Toga, whereas, you know, I write my humble column in The Guardian and I earn something like 500 times less than Alan Rusbridger, the editor of The Guardian. Although don't tell him I said that, right? I'm not playing Alan, it's nothing personal. So obviously they have, you know, much more equal society. But at the heart of it is these gender roles where the men are as involved in, you know, tremendously involved in looking after children, they're tremendously involved in the washing up, the shopping. You know, Toga has to go and do the washing up, and he has to go and shop and cook on a regular basis. And basically, you wouldn't. He explained it that you just can't hang on to your wife. Well, first of all, you can't persuade her to marry you. In fact, only half of them anyway get married, but they don't really believe in marriage. Which is rather a weakness, I think, in that system. And they do have quite a high turnover of partners, and I think that does cause a whole lot of distress. But basically, if you want to get a woman and hang on to her, you have got to prove your credentials as a domestic god, you know, that, you know, you've got to be a new man, you know. And so it's a culture, it's a values thing, and it's a culture thing, but it's also something that's been very systematically developed on purpose for, you know, 60 years. They've been doing it. They've been putting the sanity and well-being and mental health of their population ahead of the profits of a few people. Our system does the opposite.
The kind of equality that you've talked about there, is part of that brought about through the tax system?
Yes, primarily through the tax system, but also they simply don't have this nonsense, which we didn't used to have before 1979. If you were a chief executive, you only, I think you earned about maybe 30 times the average wage of your work employees. Now it's 133 times. So, you know, it's also to do with kind of culture that nobody in Denmark, they know perfectly well in Denmark, but the reason Richard Branson becomes Richard Branson is not because he's incentivized by money, but he needs to be incentivized in order to buy yet more companies and expand even more by more money, and he needs share options and all this stuff that chief executives now get, which is a key part of selfish capitalism. Defining feature is that the chief executives get significant quantities of money as shares to incentivize them, and because the share price of the company is the way it's evaluated in the English-speaking world, whereas in Denmark it isn't, and in Germany it isn't, and they have a much longer-term view. And their version of what a corporation should be doing is that it has to serve a social purpose. It's not just seen in isolation as a profit machine to make a few people very rich.
In the last 10 years or so, when caring about the environment has become fashionable for my age group, young consumers, the multinational corporations have become very, very keen on publicising how environmental they are, saying how their paper is recycled, that they're dolphin-friendly tuna or whatever. I was wondering if you thought, for the corporations, is this purely selfish, purely trying to appeal more to the people who care about it, or is there actually some sort of care by the employees of the corporations? And if not, if it is selfish, by being an environmentalist, someone who actually cares about climate change, wants to do something, does that automatically make you a political activist as well, because you're recognising capitalism is the root of the ecological crisis as it is the root of our mental health problems?
Absolutely. They dovetail together very neatly. And I think my opinion is... I'm afraid very, very cynical about that. I mean, I don't think there's any question at all that, you know, I used to interview chief executives at one point for a newspaper, and I've known various chief executives, and I don't think they could give a damn about the environment. There's never, not one moment of thought of any serious consideration about that. Of course there isn't. I mean, there wouldn't be. If you were in charge of it, there wouldn't be if you were, you know. It's not possible. If your concern is to, you know, you're being judged by your share price. So you have to just concentrate on getting maximizing profits in the short term in the English-speaking world. And you can't be fussing your head about whether your suppliers are, you know, behaving themselves or not. You can't be worrying about anything like that. Or whether you're creating, and certainly you can't be thinking about, I mean, of course you have your social responsibility and your corporate responsibility audits, but it's a fiasco. I know people who do corporate responsibility audits, and it's a complete joke. I think it's fascinating with your generation, the way that you've been trapped by Blair into, if you go to university, being trapped into debt, or whether you go to university or not, the housing market dominates your life and your future, you're kind of nailed in. Even if you don't really like it, you're nailed into, becoming a good consumer, becoming a good earner, becoming obsessed with how much you're earning, comparing how much you're earning to your peers, and it's very, very difficult for you not to. I think you know, the net effect of that, of course, is that there's also a feeling of you're working your asses off to get good GCSEs, to get good A levels, to get good degrees, in inverted commas, good degrees, you know, to get a first. What the hell does that mean? Who cares about that? But suddenly everybody does, because it's about employers. And so you're working your asses off. So no wonder you then say, right, I've suffered. I now want some pleasure. So hedonism has become, and I'm not saying my generation weren't hedonistic, because we were, but we weren't hedonistic in quite the same way. It wasn't because we didn't work, you know, we didn't do any work. So we weren't saying, right, thank God that's over. Now I need to go and just take lots of drugs for the whole weekend until I have to start the nightmare again on Monday morning. That wasn't how it was for us, whereas it is like that for you. But having said that, obviously I doubt many of the young people here subscribe to that account. I'm saying that for a significant proportion of young people, particularly those who go to university, I think it is like that. And it's a vicious way that you've been, you know, nailed to the treadmill.
You talked before about how in the media it's really difficult to separate comment from fact and opinions and things. And you also talked about to do with things like global warming and things, how there's so many different responses to it that can deny its existence or just ignore it or stick our heads in the sand. And also about the previous question as well, like there's these corporations that are kind of saying, oh, we're now like environmentally friendly or ethical or whatever it is that they're going to try and sell us. But how do we find the truth in any of it? Like, how do we work out what is the best thing to do for the people that are around us, for the people that are far away, when there's so much, I don't know, consumerism and advertisement? Where is the truth in it?
Well, I mean, I suppose if you're, you know, lucky enough to have had parents who haven't, you know, I mean, that's, you know, the very fact that you're here today makes it, unless your father is kind of the chief executive of Shell or something and you're a rebel without a cause, but it's not terribly likely, you know. So the odds are that everybody in this room roughly shares these values. And that, so in a kind of way, for you, it's not such a problem. I mean, you can watch Gossip Girl or whatever, I don't know what generation you are, but, you know, or watch Sex and the City or whatever it is, but, you know, and be more or less entertained by it, but also say, well, I can see where that's going. I don't really like that. I don't really like what those women are like. I don't really want to be like them, without me having to tell you that. So in a kind of way, you either know because you've got the right values or you haven't. And if you have got the right values, then you can quickly, but I mean, certainly, I tried to explain it in much greater length, as I was saying earlier, about the distinction between intrinsic and extrinsic. And in terms of, you know, if you ever have any difficulties, just always ask yourself, do I need this or do I want it when you're buying something? Do I really need this? You know, needs are very few. Real human needs are very, very few, for things like security, for intimacy, you know, various things like that, which we really do need. You know, we need food, but we only want, you know, a lot of the things that we buy. So if you can, and to be able to, especially for younger people, I think, to be able to understand the connection between your spending and how much work you have to do in order to pay for it. So the more you spend, the harder you have to work. And I think the credit crunch is going to be great from that point of view. I think it's going to slowly, although obviously the credit crunch is very bad news in some ways and is an astonishing trick has been played by the present government and would have been played, of course, by the Labour government, which is to blame public expenditure for the national deficit, which was, of course, actually caused by a completely screwy financial services system that had gone right out of control. It was actually caused, Nigel Lawson admitted it, the Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1987, who had the Big Bang, which deregulated financial services. He admitted not so long ago that it was him who caused the credit crunch. And so this idea of a private good, public bad, public service bad, private efficient, well, that nobody can say that with a straight face after what's just happened. The stormtroopers of the private sector turned out to be the most incompetent idiots in the history of idiocy. And And then, but astonishingly, Cameron and Osborne have managed to turn this around and say, actually, it was squandering public, it was public expenditure that jacked up our national debt. And now what's the solution? The solution is that mostly really quite low-paid people working in the public sector must take a pay freeze or a pay cut or be sacked. It's got to be paid for. It's like sending somebody into a casino to gamble and then charging the poorest people in the society, going around with a cap to the poorest people in society to pay for his debts when he gets it wrong.
Hi. We are essentially children of our generation and quite self-orientated. So when we come together to try and change the situation, we're very poor at being community-minded. And often, when an organisation sets up, it's first the elements of coming together which break it down. We don't get on with each other very well. Do you see there's any sort of mega-narratives going on there which might affect how well we get on and how which might enable us to come together better?
I think this is the main counter-argument to my arguments about the impact of selfish capitalism would be that you could say that you could explain it's possible that a lot of the greater mental illness amongst the English-speaking selfish capitalist world is actually not so much due to selfish capitalism but due to the greater individualism, and that if we could become more collectivist again, we would start to feel a lot better. And indeed, there are supporting arguments for that. For example, look at the low rates of mental illness in many Far Eastern nations, where they've adopted quite a lot of capitalist practice, but they still have very strong families. You know, in China, for example, I think they've been inoculated to a certain extent from affluenza, or from the ill effects of affluenza. They have affluenza, like there's no tomorrow, but particularly the top one third who've got any money. But they managed to be inoculated to some extent from it, the effect of it, by the fact that they still are very concerned about their parents and their grandparents. That's the foundation of the Chinese system, still, even amongst the Chinese young. This is the elephant in the room in many ways, that if you raise this, people start to get pretty damn stroppy. And one simple example is feminism. What were we to make of feminism? Well, feminism, to my way of thinking, feminism in the English-speaking world, the English-speaking men in skirts version of feminism, which is, you know, Nicola Horlick, Harriet Harman, I'm as good as any man, I'm as nasty as any man, I can smoke as many cigarettes as any man, I can drink as much as any man, I can shag as many men as any man can shag women, etc. In other words, in a lot of ways, what happened in America, the American version of feminism that we've got, was simply saying, let's women adopt all the worst characteristics, or many of the worst characteristics of men, and men, no change at all, or minimal change. I mean, I think men have changed. I think men are more involved with their children than they were, but they're still basically, look at all the studies, mostly the household economy is still largely run by women. They do nearly all the housework, etc. We're nowhere near Denmark in that regard. And so the idea that the feminism that I knew in the mid-70s, where you'd have men's grouping, which men would sit around studying their, studying their own psyches and thinking how awful, saying, oh, we men are terrible, we really are too aggressive, we're such bad people. That kind of feminism totally evaporated. Now, I mean, as a big part of that, of course, for the American feminism is a massive rise of individualism amongst American women and British women. And American women, for example, are now as narcissistic as American men were. Only 15% of American women were what's called narcissists, that is me, 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 self-aggrandizing, I'm the center of attention, look at me type of people. Only 15% of women were like that in the 60s. By the mid-80s, it was 40%, the same proportion as, surprisingly low. You think Americans, you'd think at least 80% would be narcissists, but no, it's only 40%. And something similar, has happened over here. So, you know, who's going to, you know, standing up and saying that doesn't, you don't make yourself popular, believe you me, you don't make yourself popular if you start saying things like that, particularly if you say them on Women's Hour. But I think it's a fact. I think that, of course, you know, obviously, I totally agree with you. That I think, but exactly how you tackle this, how you start to curb people's individualism, start to say to people, before, you know, think twice before you get divorced. Look at the evidence of the harm that divorce does to the divorcees. There's very good evidence that I quote in Affluenza, a study of 10,000 women, a proportion of whom 3 years later had got divorced. And by and large, in 80% of cases, they felt a lot worse than when they were in their marriage, even if their marriage was terrible. Only about a fifth of them really felt better. So it's a total myth, actually, that divorce is, you know, and I actually had this argument with David Aronovich the other day, who was saying, oh, isn't it wonderful that everyone gets divorced? I'm saying, no, it bloody well isn't. But again, you know, that's not a popular argument. So I don't know how it's going to, and it doesn't suit Rupert Murdoch, and it doesn't suit selfish capitalism. You know, a lot of money is made out of divorce, actually. Selfish capitalism loves divorce. You need two homes, two TVs, two washing machines. You know, I'm sorry, but it's not something that is this idea of freedom and choice and opportunity that Blair used those words, and of course Thatcher before, actually consisted of saying the freedom to borrow vast amounts of money and to behave badly. That's really what it boiled down to. The increase, the most amazing statistic, 200 billion was the amount in 1979. The amount of personal household debt, that had risen to 500 billion by 1990, but by 2008 it had risen from 500 billion to 1,400 billion, 1.4 trillion. Now that is unbelievable, and you could say, "Oh, how democratic!" That means it's not just the rich, posh people who've got the money now. Anybody can have access to this money, except for we saw what happened, you know. We saw, the vast majority of this money just went into increasing house prices. So actually nobody has this money. All it is that huge amounts of money are made by financial services out of this arrangement. But we, however, can't, you know, find it increasingly hard to afford any kind of home. And our children can't possibly. Tackling individualism is definitely something that needs to be done. And it is a complicated argument, but it's partly to do with, definitely to do with not having selfish capitalism. Although that in itself wouldn't solve the problem, because there are very profound value changes that have happened. And somebody's going to have to work out, you know, somebody. What we need is politicians who are really addressing these questions and discussing them in public. Yeah.
I think we've only got time for these last three questions, so we'll continue with them.
Hi, I'm one of the 23% with a mental health problem. I'm also a researcher in the field. And I guess I'm going to come, I'll tell you the short question and then I'll say a bit about it, which is, how can we make collectivism more inclusive? Because basically, yeah, I mean, I take your point that, I mean, people in the developing world, people in low and middle income countries, the World Health Organization has known for a long, long time in research that they have better rates, maybe twice the rate of recovery, where they have no mental health services, where communities look after each other and people are included.
That's right.
Now, in France, you mentioned Europe. I mean, apparently the situation in France, I've been told by someone who works in the system, is that there are half the people in France in the mental health system as there are here. However, once you're in the mental health system in France, you don't get out. So I guess people try really, really hard not to let people know they've got mental health problems. I was just thinking about the politicians who have had the most effect on people with mental health problems inclusion in this country. And everyone would be surprised to know that it was Enoch Powell who brought in the Community Care Act in the 60s, and it was Margaret Thatcher who started off the deinstitutionalisation, which allowed people out of the asylums, which, from my opinion, is a big step forward. So it's not necessarily the most individualist and consumerist people who are against the inclusion of people with mental health services. And I suppose I'd like you to say something also about the big society and how that might be an opportunity to include people such as myself and the 23% of people with mental health problems in society, in our churches as well, where people can get the most amount of support from the community. Also, I just wanted to say one last thing about this green belt. I don't know if I'm the only person here who wonders why we're here at a bookies office. It seems very odd to me that, 20 years ago, before the National Lottery came in, we didn't think into it. I would have thought most Christians would have been against coming somewhere like this. So, that's my question. How can we make collectivism work?
Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time, so perhaps we need to go into that, and perhaps we can talk about it in more detail in the other tent. But my short answer to that would certainly be that I think that you don't enable people who are mentally ill to feel more included by sort of politically correct gibberish, which is a lot of what goes on in social care. There's a lot of sort of trying to pretend that, people who are feeling depressed or people who are hearing voices or people who are suffering from bipolar or whatever it is, that they're no different from everybody else. Well, actually, they are. It is different. When I've been depressed, I am different from, if I stop taking nicotine, I go into a serious clinical depression. I ingest it through lozenges. And yes, I am different from other people. So, I don't think political correctitude is the way out. I think it's much more, as you said, there is this amazingly interesting evidence from the developing world where you're much, much more likely, you're much less likely to become schizophrenic if you're living in a jungle in the Amazon. And if you do become schizophrenic, you're much more likely to recover than if some drug company representative known as a psychiatrist pumps you full of pills, which actually have worse side effects than the actual problems of hearing voices in the first place if you've got schizophrenia. So, the kind of collectivism and it's just sort of seen as part of the warp and woof of humanity to a large degree in the developing world. If you get depressed or if you start talking strange, there's a far greater tolerance of it and a far greater support if people are in real distress, and that obviously is a much better alternative. I don't think that's fully answered your question, but I think we've run out of time pretty much.
Hello. I just wondered if you could give us your views on the connection between capitalism and the rising levels of addiction within our society, and also if you could say something very briefly on how the capitalism of the haves affects the mental health of the have-nots.
Yes. Regarding addiction, it's very simple, really. We become a kind of it. My favourite expression for this is to say we become an it could be you, shop till you drop, credit fueled consumer junkies. So and this nonsense about an addiction gene for which they have no evidence at all. But it is true that what actually causes emotional problems is early childhood neglect and deprivation or maltreatment in your early years creates a vulnerability, creates a neediness, which if you then throw, and of course in America, half the population are in a daycare centre before the age of one because they've got this idea that the women all have to be going back to work because nobody can afford not to. That's the system. So you create a very needy population, which is great for selfish capitalism. The more, the worse the early childhood, the better, basically. And that's why the UNICEF report showed that we were bottom. We were the worst at looking after our children. Clearly, you're the exception. We were the worst, and the Americans were the second worst. And it's great for selfish capitalism. The needier everyone is, the more aholias there are. And so the rise of addiction, well, obviously, under New Labour, the making it a piece of cake for the supermarkets to sell beer for kind of practically the price of tap water, and creating unlimited drinking hours, I'm surprised they didn't nationalize heroin and make, you know, make money out of that too. You know, I mean, there's not, there didn't seem to be any place they weren't prepared to go. I mean, the casinos, the gambling, the way they created gambling, as the gentleman earlier referred to, gambling is a serious problem. Debt is a massive cause of mental illness, and most of the Aholias lead to debt. If people who have six or more debts, Rachel Jenkins's famous study showed, you know, that explains that why there's something like six times more likely to be mentally ill than people who have no debt. And the increasing numbers and kinds of debts is what causes that. But it's interesting, but that actually overrides the impact. Once that means that the effect of being in a low social class or being poor is actually disappears once you take debt into account. So, absolutely, selfish capitalism thrives on creating addictions of all kinds, whether it's to shopping for handbags or for expensive, ridiculous handbags, or for you know, drinking too much or whatever. And I think that's probably all we've got time for. So the wider question, with your wider question, was on capitalism and
Capitalism affects, because a lot of your writing is about the haves.
Yes. Yes.
How that impacts the mental health of the have-nots. I work as an addictions therapist for the have-nots, you see. And it's constantly a question that sort of pops into my head. How much is this an effect of the capitalism of the haves?
Well, obviously, absolutely. I think my answer to that is it kind of goes without saying in my work, and certainly my earlier work was much more about the impact of selfish capitalism on, because it increases the proportion of the population who are poor, and it increases the extent of the gap between the richest and the poorest, and that cranks up the difficulties of being poor. So actually, in America, at the change of the end of the 19th century, Americans, it was the gap between rich and poor was three times greater than it is now, and it's bloody enormous now. But actually, being poor in America at that time was nowhere near as painful as it is now, because they didn't have TV saying anyone could be president, it's your fault if you're poor, etc., etc. Everyone, there was a class system, and there was nobody would have imagined they were going to be anything but poor if they started off poor. Whereas in our society, actually, if you start off poor, you've got very little chance of not ending up poor, but you're given to believe that you have got a chance, and that it's your fault if you fail. Loser, you know.
I would actually take it one step further. I would say that capitalism creates addiction. I think it's the nucleus of it.
It thrives on it, yeah.